Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Ewald Nowotny, the author of Geld und Leben, probably best translated in its context as Your Money and Your Life, published in October by Braumüller. Professor Nowotny today calls himself an independent economist, but for 11 years from the collapse of Lehman Brothers until September last year, he ran the Austrian National Bank and was a high-profile member of the European Central Bank's Governing Council. A professor of economics in Vienna and Linz, he was elected to the Austrian Parliament as a Social Democrat in 1978. He has served as a vice president of the European Investment Bank and as CEO of private bank BAWAG before his nomination to the Central Bank in 2008. As the title of the book implies, it's a description of growing up in post-war Vienna, and of a political and literary education as well, as a memoir of a turbulent decade in European banking and economic policy making. Ewald, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Tim. Glad to hear you.
Many people have passed through the ECB's Governing Council since its creation, but only a few have written about the experience, and nobody, to my knowledge, has written both a policy-making memoir and a personal autobiography. What made you decide to be the first one to do this?
Yeah, this was exactly my idea, that I think it might be of interest to give a bit of an information about how do you reach your decisions, who is the person behind the official side, what is the education, what is the political development. And, of course, you cannot generalize this, so I concentrate on my own experiences in these three areas, the area of economic theory, so as a professor, the area of politics, and the area of banking.
Yeah, and as I alluded to at the beginning, you explain that the title is a reference to the old threat from highwaymen, your money or your life.
Yes.
And that you wanted to challenge the idea of antithesis, you know, as a philosophy of life. Could you explain more what you mean by that?
Perhaps it was a bit simpler than that. It was just that, of course, in my life, in my career, I had to do a lot with money affairs. And in fact, as I am showing in this book, I'm interested in monetary affairs since my kind of childhood already. This is based on lifelong experiences, and in private experiences, it was for me very important also to show in this book that you are not kind of doing this alone, but that you are part of a group of people who help you, starting with your family, starting with your friends. In my case, it was very important for me that as an academic, I had been assistant to Professor Kurt Rothschild, so where I learned a lot, both for life and for economics. Mm-hmm. And so this combination was what was my idea about writing this book.
Yeah, and alongside your academic career, you made an early commitment to social democratic politics and ended up as an elected politician in your mid-30s. Can you tell us how that came about? Your proximity to the very famous Chancellor Bruno Kreisky, and how much those politics still inform your worldview?
Yes, this is something I describe. I describe in this book. On the one hand, of course, my family is a kind of bourgeois family, but both my father and my mother had been already social democrats, the first in this family life. So, of course, I grew up in some way with these ideas. I then, at a rather early start, became, as a student already, I worked with the Austrian trade union movement as an economic assistant. So I came in touch with this, let's say, with the practical side. And then in my student times, I became a member of the Social Democratic Students. When I then moved to the University of Linz, I kind of abandoned politics for quite some time. And then I was kind of called again as an economic expert by Chancellor Kreisky, whom I knew since quite some time, and I was a good friend with his son, Peter. As I say in this book, I was not too eager to enter politics because I felt very comfortable in my life as a professor. And I remember Bruno Kreisky saying to me, "You are much too young to live a comfortable life." And I kind of accepted this, that one has a certain duty to the public. And so for about 20 years, I had kind of a double life. On the one hand, as a professor, I was fully active as a teacher, first at the University of Linz and then at the Economic University of Vienna, and as a member of parliament, where I became the chairman of the finance committee.
Yeah, it seemed to me that in the book, there were two areas where perhaps your social democratic politics are still present. One was several times you talked about how Portugal was a good example in your view of a pragmatic middle ground between fiscal consolidation and the need for growth expansion. But also when you're looking at more generally at the sort of long crisis in banking and the impact of rising asset prices, you talk about the need for a good social housing program in developed countries. Am I right in picking out those two areas of where your politics are still present in your economic views?
It is perhaps a bit more fundamental than that, because what I also describe in this book is my priority for politics of full employment, because I see unemployment not only as an economic problem, but also as a vast social problem. And I describe in my stay in the U.S., I had working at Harvard University, and I met there a number of Austrians who had to flee the Nazis and with whom we talked about how the Nazis succeeded in gaining majorities. And it was really mainly due to this horrible unemployment of the big economic crisis of the 1930s, which was especially horrible in Austria. So for me, a policy of full employment is an economic issue, but very much also a social issue and also a political issue. You know that the ECB has as a primary goal price stability. The Federal Reserve in the US, they have a so-called double mandate. So that means price stability and full employment. And basically, of course, as a governor, I followed the legal basis of the ECB, but de facto, I always had the employment effects in mind, which is, of course, not really a problem in the time that we lived, where we had, of course, the need for expansionary policy, monetary policy, anyhow. So this is my basic point, and it is also today what I see as the first challenge for economic policy. The rest are kind of side effects. Of course, for instance, I discussed this with regard to housing, where I clearly have the opinion that interest rate policies, policy of giving loans to households who cannot afford to buy back these loans, ends in a disaster. This is exactly what happened in the U.S. This was kind of a politically oriented policy to to afford to make housing affordable for poor, so to make them, let's say, closer to bring them in the capitalist surrounding. But it didn't work. It was one of the reasons for this big housing catastrophe that we had. So therefore, I think it is, if you want to do social policy, you have to do it directly, for instance, via social housing. And so I think it is important to see what can you do via monetary policy and what can you not do, where you need different direct approaches from the public sector.
Yeah, do you think in real terms there is a great difference between the single mandate and the dual mandate of the great central banks? Because as you implied there, when you're setting interest rate policy with an eye on inflation in the future, I mean, clearly employment is going to be an absolutely crucial factor in that in any case. So do you think it's overstated, the difference between the single and the dual mandate?
Well, there might be a difference if we, not at the moment, where we have extremely low inflation rates, so that therefore the aim of price stability is also needs expansionary monetary policy. Mm-hmm. As you know, the ECB defines price stability as an inflation rate of not above, but close to 2%. So we are way below. So therefore, it goes the same way. It could become a problem in this when we see kind of increasing inflation. And this is exactly the discussion that we have just now in the US, where the US policy says that if we have had a time of underachievement in inflation, of too low inflation, we may have to accept a time where inflation may be above the target. This is, at least as yet, not the policy of the ECB, but there is, like other central banks, the ECB also in the process of a policy review, and we will see the outcome of this policy review.
So this is the idea of a sort of period of catch-up for having missed the inflation target for such a long
period.
Yes,
it's called inflation averaging. So that the basic idea is to give a message to the markets, an expansionary message to the markets. How effective this is something to be debated. I'm not so sure about that. But we have had a practical experience when we had the first banking crisis after 2008. Then there was a certain upswing in the economy. And at this time, the ECB already increased interest rates. But out of fear that this might have higher inflationary effects. This was clearly a mistake. The first thing Mario Draghi did was to revise this, because it caused a double dip in the European economy in contrast to the US. And this is one of the main reasons why economic growth in the US had been much stronger than economic growth in the euro area.
Yes, but as you say in the book, the main problem there seemed to be that the governing, two issues. The governing council had the separation principle, but also you were looking very much at inflation in the short term rather than in sort of medium to long term as a genuine threat coming from an endogenous threat from the economy. But you make a very interesting point later in the book, where you're looking at the potential ideas for the ECB strategy review, where you say that you had been skeptical about this idea of pursuing or communicating to markets that you intended to get inflation above 2% for a period, because it wasn't really credible in this environment. And isn't that the problem at the moment, that even if the ECB said, we intend for inflation to exceed 2% for a long period. The markets just can't believe that inflation is going to get to that level for a very long time.
Yeah, this definitely is a problem. One has to be aware that the long-term developments of inflation rates are only partially due to the policies of central banks, but we have long-term economic trends of what is called the natural rate of inflation. That means the rate of inflation without influence of central banks, that this natural rate of inflation has a downward trend. And there are a number of explanations for that. One is the effects of globalization that clearly mean higher kind of competition in the world economy and a downward trend in prices. Another aspect is that to a certain extent, the what's called structural reforms de facto meant a weakening of the power of trade unions, so that wage increases are much lower than to be expected. This is this problem of the so-called Phillips curve. So we have kind of also without central bank policy, we have a trend towards lower inflation rates. And I think this is something where central banks in some way have to adjust, because as I said, it is a problem of credibility. If you have an inflation goal where you are pretty sure that you will not achieve it, even, let's say, in the medium term.
Yeah. Well, I recommend any ECB watchers to read this book, in particular chapter 17, the life of a governing council member. And here you take us through the 2 to 3 day experience of attending the meetings in Frankfurt and really how this changed between the presidencies of Jean-Claude Trichet and Mario Draghi. Could you expand on this for listeners about how the process changed during those 2 periods?
Well, of course, you see, the governing council consists of the governors of the European central banks that are part of the euros, the euro area, and the executive board of the ECB. So this is a group that is, of course, has also some kind of group dynamics, like every group. And it is a group where we have kind of different traditions to follow. So we have, of course, let's say, the group of what had been called the hard currency countries. That means Germany and the countries that historically had pegged their currency to Germany, like the Netherlands and also like Austria. We have, of course, the group of the southern countries. And it is always a great challenge to combine these different traditions. With Trichet, he took great pains to get at kind of an unanimous agreement. So we had rather long sessions. And at the end of the day, I think we reached some compromises. Mario Draghi had kind of a different approach, especially in the later years of his tenure, where he wanted to reach quite fast results and was more prepared also to take a vote and to have majority decisions. So that makes quite a substantial difference for the total kind of atmosphere of a group. As far as I understand now with Madame Lagarde, I think she's again more trying to get this more kind of compromise-oriented approach. And in any case, in this the time of a big crisis as we have it now with COVID, it is quite clear that there is de facto only one sensible approach. So there would not be many differences in the governing council. It is in times that are kind of more normal times that these different approaches may appear.
Yeah, I was particularly interested in what you said about the monetary policy accounts. These are the sort of minutes or summaries of the meetings that are published a few weeks after the meeting. And you say that given the pressure to claim unanimity, which is very important as a communication to markets, you say that gave governors leverage to get their real opinions across in the accounts. Was that a very common maneuver by people?
Well, there have not been that many occasions where this was relevant, because I would say for 90% of all decisions, there was basic unanimity in the governing council. But of course, it's these issues where there is no common perspective that are most interesting. And yes, this there, of course, it was some kind of a way to achieve some kind of compromise. And as we are all aware that the accounts are read by the markets exact way, one really has every word has a meaning. I think it's even more important in the report of the president before he has his press conference after a monetary policy meeting of the governing council. This written report is something that is also discussed before the president reads it to the journalists. And again, here every single word may give a message to the markets. So it is something that you really have to take your time to discuss it. And this was exactly the main field where there have been some discussions.
Is there a structural problem here in the sense of the, and you do touch on this, that the very large size of this committee that eventually led, for example, to the frustration of Draghi, that you say that he developed a kitchen cabinet and the wider committee ended up being sometimes ignored. So, yeah. You know, if you were starting again, would the council be smaller, do you think?
It would be very difficult to achieve this. But there would be another model. As you mentioned, I had been for some time a vice president of the European Investment Bank, which is also a European institution. In the European Investment Bank, we have, let's say, a two-class society in some way that the big countries are permanently represented at the executive board, and the smaller countries are part of constituencies. So that, let's say, five smaller countries together have form a constituency, and they have then a member in the executive board. And this is a bit also the same as we have it in the International Monetary Fund. That might be perhaps more effective in some way. On the other hand, of course, central bank policy is a very, very sensitive issue for every member country of the euro area. It was not so easy to give up their national currency for the euro, so that it made sense to have all member countries on board. Now, with the increasing number of members of the eurozone, there is an agreement that the number of voting members will be reduced, or will not be equal to the number of those members that are there. But and this is a kind of changing every half year or so. It doesn't make much of a difference, because still, and I think this is correct, you are able to sit on the table. So I think this is, as one has to see, monetary policy, we have this very specific issue that in the EU system, monetary policy is a European affair. at least for the Euro countries, which I think is a very good thing and which is a progress, but still means that there has to be some kind of representation. As you know, fiscal policy is still not a European affair. And there you have the ministers directly kind of bargaining with each other. I think this more discrete system of the ECB is better.
Yeah, actually, on that point, you make a point in the book that has real resonance today. You took over the National Bank just 2 weeks later. Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy protection, and you said during that crisis period, you said, "I've learned that crisis management is still most effective on the ground, and personal presence cannot be replaced by electronic communication." Obviously, this is very relevant now. Why, in your view, does it matter so much to have this face-to-face interaction? Is it difficult to make negotiation work remotely?
Well, the official meetings are only the tip of an iceberg. So when we come to Frankfurt, of course, there are a lot of bilateral talks. There are you get some kind of additional information. All this is much more difficult if it is not a physical meeting. In times like these, there is no real alternative. And it is working because it can be based on former physical meetings, so you know each other. So you can have a conference, an electronic conference, better if you know each other and so on. But I would be really very concerned if this would be for a longer period of time. And I think that especially for these policy meetings, physical presence is quite important. It's different from purely technical aspects. So this is something that you can do online, but if it is about formation of policies, I think the physical presence is important.
Coming back to policy, you say in the book that the ECB has assigned great importance to forward guidance. So this is this idea that central banks give an intention about where interest rates will be over a long period, and other factors, but mostly interest rates. But you say this importance, this great importance, in your view, has been too great. I think others would argue that this has been highly successful policy and comparatively cheap. What do you have against it? What is your problem with what the ECB has done?
You see, there is, let's say, one school in economics that is very much based on expectations, and especially rational expectations. And this forward guidance, in some way, is an outcome of this economic thinking. I am personally not so sure whether this is really that decisive for market participants. Market participants have, in my view, in my experience, much more influenced by direct short-term experiences and short-term views. They can be influenced if you have a clear policy in some way, which is an overall policy. But the promise to keep, let's say, interest rates low for long term as such, I think would not be very powerful if it is not combined with an actual perspective that this will be the case, but it will be the case anyhow. And you could not do forward guidance, or I think it would not be successful if it would be in pure contradiction to what the markets expect from market perspectives. So I think it is an element, yes, but it is perhaps not too decisive, and it has one important problem that comes with it. That means that central bank policy then becomes not only is influencing the markets, but that market and market expectations also influence very much monetary policy, which in some way might be okay. So one should not necessarily surprise markets. But I think in some instances, it makes sense to surprise markets and thus to avoid some speculative bubbles. So in my book, I also review the policy of the Federal Reserve in the US, where they sometimes surprised markets, which was criticized very much, but which I think was the right thing to do.
Yes, I was racking my brain trying to think of recent examples of central bank surprising markets deliberately. I mean, it's been done accidentally a few times, and the obvious one was the Fed's taper tantrum.
Yeah,
I mean. Yeah,
I think sorry. Which got a very a very bad press, but I think this taper tantrum was necessary in some way, just to show that just to say be careful, there are risks with your expectations.
Do you think once we're coming out of this crisis, the market will do its own work for it, in the sense that the negative impact this year has been so enormous that the market expectations for a bounce are actually quite heavily optimistic, which means that expectations will, in all sorts of areas, including interest rates, will probably change very quickly as well? Or do you think is there a danger of the central banks implying that rates will stay much at these kind of rates for a much longer period?
Well, of course, just now we have a huge amount of uncertainty. So therefore, as long as we have this, I think the policy of the central banks has to be to try to reduce uncertainty. The first point is really to provide liquidity to more or less unconditional whatever is needed. And the other one is, in this case also, with regard to interest rates, to have a policy of long-term low interest rates. So I think in this kind of a very deep crisis, it is quite obvious, and I think there is also no major differences among the members of the governing council. Things get more diverse if we have a change the better, and especially if this economic improvement is not uniform, but some countries are getting out of the crisis faster than others. And then, I think then we will have to, this will be a time of perhaps difficult discussions. But I'm afraid this will come at a much later date.
Yes. Well, you say something quite intriguing, actually, towards the end of the book, where you say that your views are close to those of Adair Turner. The idea of partial direct central bank money creation. Are you implying there that the pandemic-related asset purchases should essentially be forgiven or retired? What are you implying when you make that comment?
Well, what you see is, of course, that as a kind of side effect of the crisis, we have a huge increase of public debt. And this huge increase of public debt poses no problem as long as we have very low interest rates. But it would be, I think, dangerous that therefore the volume of debt is kind of dictating interest rate policy. And therefore, I think it makes sense to make a distinction between these two elements, and so that a part of this public debt is public debt, would be public debt to central banks. The problem of monetary financing is, of course, that it might have inflationary effects if it is not properly controlled. And I think that the ECB is the most independent central bank of the world, because the independence is enshrined in the EU treaties, and there is no way how to change these treaties. This is different from, let's say, the US, where the independence of the Fed is based on American laws, and these laws can be changed. So therefore, the ECB is really independent, and therefore a certain amount of monetary financing could be done via the ECB without problems of dangers of inflation. So, for instance, what I allude to is that, for instance, the financing of the ESM, of the European Stability Mechanism, is, I think, there is no real good economic foundation why it has to be done on the capital markets. I think this is something that could be done by the ECB, via the ECB, because it is something that can be controlled, so to be on the right way. One has to say, of course, this we are bound by the European treaty. Again, it will be not easy to change the European treaties in this way. But as now, let's say, a free-thinking economist, I think that this might be a very important element if we want to have to get a new positive equilibrium for the European economy.
Yeah, I could see a problem there with the ESM in that during this crisis, governments have been reluctant to go to the ESM. What instead has happened is that the ECB has stepped in with the pandemic emergency purchase program, and we've had the creation of this new recovery facility that will come next year. So realistically, if you were to have a monetary financing solution to this crisis, it seems to me that the only solution would be for the ECB to retire the element of the balance sheet that's come from the PEP purchases. Do you think that would be possible?
Well, technically, yes. Legally, it would be a challenge, of course.
Yeah.
I think, and therefore, it will be a very long process of rethinking in this way. But one has to be aware that the situation of a single member country of the Eurozone is very different from the situation of a country that has public debt in their own currency, like the US, like Japan. In these cases, there is never kind of a default risk, because rightly so, markets know that the central bank would intervene. For a country of the Eurozone, the euro is technically a foreign currency. So that means they cannot create this currency. They have no access to finance to monetary financing. So that means a country of the Eurozone technically can go into default. And we have seen that this is a situation where we were very close at this in some cases. And so therefore, I think one has to develop some kind of additional instruments that create a combination, a connection between fiscal policy and monetary policy.
But in your view, that would probably require a treaty amendment.
Yes, I think one has to be quite aware of that. So it is not something that could develop into short-term changes. But on the other hand, you could have some kind of intermediate steps. This is why I bring in the ESM, so that you could have some kind of intermediation way that, at least as far as I see it, would be in line with the European treaties.
And I guess that might in turn make borrowing from the ESM more attractive.
Well, this is then a different aspect. as you know, the ESM is aware of this problem, and therefore the ESM has developed also a lending program that is kind of less stringent than the traditional one. The problem with the ESM, of course, is the ESM is not a supranational institution. It is based on it's an international institution, so that there is every decision needs the direct agreement of the member countries, in some cases even including parliamentary agreement. So that is kind of a technical problem, but this is in the field of the ASM, and I think basically it was a progress to have this, and it may have now to evolve in some way.
Yeah. Well, I my final question, and since this is a podcast about books, you write about your love of books in your book, which is so great that you came close to buying a bookshop.
Yes, not very successfully, I have to say.
No. Well, it was close, but no cigar. Have you during your retirement have you had the opportunity to do a lot of reading both in economics and outside it? And do you have an economics book, for example, that you've read in the last year that you would recommend?
A book I would recommend, it is not a new book, but now in the last year I had time to read it in more detail, is the memoir of Ben Bernanke. Because on the one hand, this is, and this was a bit of a model, of course, not the same kind of class for my book, because it is a mixture of personal memoir and kind of a short version of an introduction to monetary policy, and then, of course, a specific discussion of the policy events where he had been. And I think this combination, for me, is a very interesting one, and I would think this is a book that should be on the reading list of every economics course or monetary policy course at universities.
Right. And a book outside economics that you read in the last year?
I have to say what I'm starting or started is kind of rereading books that I have been reading when I was young, but that are too voluminous then to read it. And so I have started rereading Tolstoy, War and Peace, which is a really fascinating story. And I'm not finished, but I'm just in the midst of it.
Okay. Well, today, Evald Novotný and I have been discussing his book, Geld und Leben, published in October by Bram Müller. Evald, thank you very much for joining the podcast.
Thank you. And thank you for this interesting conversation we had. Thank you.